A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to dig into the history of Lower Greenville in Dallas. And I have to admit, I didn't know much about it. But once I started reading, I realized this is one of those neighborhoods where you can trace the entire arc of a city in a few square miles. The rise, the decline, the reinvention, the tension between old character and new money. It's all there.
It really is. And what grabbed me right away is that Lower Greenville isn't some ancient district. It's basically a 20th century story.
All right. So where do we even start with Lower Greenville? Because this isn't just a neighborhood. It's this long arc from farmland to streetcar suburb to counterculture hub to dining destination. And each era leaves its mark.
Let's start with what Greenville Avenue actually was before it was Greenville Avenue. This was originally a rural farm-to-market road heading northeast out of Dallas. We're talking late 1800s. I was going to say, you sound more organized than usual. Greenville Road, as it was called then, was named because it eventually connected Dallas to the town of Greenville about 50 miles northeast.
It's literally a road to Greenville. Not exactly a poetic origin story.
And along that line, little commercial clusters started popping up. Grocery stores, drug stores, barber shops, the kind of stuff people needed within walking distance.
It's a classic streetcar suburb, Batten. But here's what I find interesting. It wasn't called Lower Greenville back then, was it?
No, not at all. The lower part came much later. Originally, it was just Greenville Avenue, the whole corridor. And the area we now call Lower Greenville, roughly from Ross Avenue up to Mockingbird Lane, was just a series of small commercial nodes. Each one had its own identity. You had the Belmont section, the Vickery section. It wasn't one unified neighborhood. The promise was, you can live out here in the fresh air, with a yard and trees, and still commute downtown in 20 minutes.
It's the same logic as post-war suburbanization, just 50 years earlier, and on rails instead of highways.
So you get a lot more traffic, a lot more businesses. And crucially, you start seeing the first real entertainment venues. Restaurants, music clubs, the kinds of places people drive to for a night out. Slaughter owned thousands of acres northeast of the city, and he saw the streetcar coming.
That's a name that demands respect.
So it didn't get bypassed the way some other commercial strips did when the interstates came through. The trolley reached Belmont by 1909, and suddenly these lots started selling. Small craftsman bungalows, a few prairie-style houses, some modest commercial buildings at the key intersections. The 60s and 70s. That's the golden era for the music scene. You had places like the Village Theater, which opened in the 30s as a movie house, but later became a live music venue.
This is the built environment that still defines Lower Greenville today, right? Those bungalows are still there.
They absolutely are. If you walk the side streets off Greenville, Llano, Orem, Velasco, Vanderbilt, you're looking at houses built between roughly 1910 and 1925. It was eclectic. You had country and western acts, sure, this is Texas, but you also had blues, rock, and later punk and new wave. Lower Greenville was never a one-genre kind of place. It attracted a mixed crowd. College students from SMU, working-class families, artists, musicians. That diversity was part of its identity.
You've got this thriving corridor. Restaurants, bars, music venues. It sounds like the kind of place where you'd want to spend a Friday night. What goes wrong?
A few things. And they're interconnected. First, you have the broader pattern of suburban flight in the 70s and 80s. As Dallas sprawled further north, Plano, Richardson, all those suburbs, the inner ring neighborhood started losing population and investment. Lower Greenville was still busy, but the surrounding residential areas were aging. Lower Greenville was a self-contained village within the city. You had grocery stores, barber shops, drug stores, a movie theater, churches, all within walking distance.
The 15-minute city before it was a buzzword.
And the key commercial anchor was the Granada Theater, which opened in 1946 at Greenville and Belmont. That's still there. It's a live music venue now, but it started as a single-screen movie palace. Art Deco design, neon marquee, the whole thing. The Granada was the heart of Lower Greenville for decades.
I want to pause on the Granada for a second, because movie theaters in the 1940s were a big deal. This wasn't just a place to see a film. It was the center of social life, especially for teenagers and young couples.
And the Granada opened at this interesting moment, right after World War II, when Dallas was booming. The city's population grew from about 295,000 in 1940 to over 434,000 in 1950. A lot of those new arrivals were young families, and they settled in neighborhoods like Lower Greenville. The Granada was built for them.
We've got this stable, prosperous neighborhood to the 40s and 50s.
The 60s happened, and in Dallas, the 60s meant two things: white flight to the suburbs, and the counterculture finding its foothold. Lower Greenville got both.
Let's take those one at a time. White flight. This is the classic post-war story, right? New highways, new subdivisions further out, families with means leaving the inner ring neighborhoods.
Dallas built the Central Expressway, US 75, in the 1950s, which made it easy to live in places like Richardson or Plano and commute downtown. Then the interstate system added I-635 and the LBJ Freeway. Suddenly, Lower Greenville wasn't the fresh air alternative to the city, it was the old neighborhood you left behind. Property value stagnated. Some of the bungalows became rentals. The commercial strip started to look a little tired.
At the same time, the 60s counterculture was looking for exactly that kind of place. Cheap rents, funky old buildings, a little bit of grit.
By the late 60s and early 70s, Lower Greenville had become one of Dallas's bohemian enclaves. The stretch around Greenville and Orem in particular, that became the heart of what people called the Greenville Avenue scene. Head shops, record stores, used bookstores, vegetarian restaurants before that was mainstream. A lot of musicians and artists lived in the neighborhood. It was Dallas's version of Haight-Ashbury, scaled down and Texas-fied.
This is where the St. Patrick's Day Parade comes in, right? Because that's become one of the defining events of Lower Greenville.
The parade started in 1979, and it wasn't a city-sanctioned thing at first. It was basically a bar crawl that grew legs. A few of the pubs along Greenville, and there were a lot of them by the late 70s, decided to do something for St. Patrick's Day. Someone had the idea to block off a few blocks and actually march. The first parade was tiny, maybe a few hundred people, but it caught on fast.
Now it's one of the largest St. Patrick's Day parades in the country.
It draws over 100,000 people some years. It's a massive event, and it's also been a source of tension, which we should talk about. But let's stay with the timeline. The 1980s were the peak of Lower Greenville as a nightlife destination. The bars, the live music venues, the restaurants, it was the place to go out in Dallas. Deep Ellum was also big at that time, but Lower Greenville had a slightly different vibe. A little less industrial, a little more neighborhood bar energy mixed in with the music scene.
I've heard people who were there in the 80s describe it as this incredible moment. You could walk down Greenville on a Friday night and hear five different bands playing in five different venues, all within a few blocks. Jazz at one place, punk at another, Texas country at a third.
That diversity of venues was possible because the commercial buildings were small and relatively cheap to lease. You didn't need a corporate backer to open a bar or a club, you just needed a few thousand dollars and a tolerance for long hours. That low barrier to entry created this really organic, unpredictable mix of businesses.
That same thing, the low barrier, the informality, it also created problems, right? By the 90s, Lower Greenville had a reputation.
Crime was up. There were issues with late-night crowds spilling into residential streets, noise complaints, public intoxication, parking nightmares. The neighborhood association started pushing back hard. There was a real conflict between people who saw Lower Greenville as an entertainment district and people who saw it as their home.
This tension between residents and bar owners, it's basically the central political drama of Lower Greenville for about 20 years.
From the mid-90s through about 2010, yeah. And it came to a head in the early 2000s. The city started imposing stricter regulations on bars. Occupancy limits, parking requirements, noise ordinances. Some of the older venues closed. There was a period where it felt like Lower Greenville might lose its identity entirely.
It didn't. Something else happened instead.
The restaurant renaissance happened. Starting around 2010, you saw this wave of chef-driven restaurants opening on Lower Greenville. Not bars, not clubs, serious food destinations. And they changed the economics and the culture of the strip.
I want to talk about why that happened when it did, because it's not random. Dallas's food scene was exploding nationally around that time. You had chefs getting James Beard nominations. You had food media paying attention to Dallas in a way they never had before. There's also the parking situation, which I gather has been a perennial complaint.
Perennial is an understatement. Parking on Lower Greenville has been a headache for decades. The old commercial buildings were built before anyone imagined the kind of density the strip has now. So you have limited off-street parking, and the residential side streets get flooded with visitors' cars. It's a constant source of friction between businesses and neighbors.
The city solution?
They've tried various things. Permit parking on some residential streets, a few small public lots, but there's no magic fix. The street was designed for a different era. One of the ironies is that the old streetcar line solved this problem automatically. People arrived on foot from the streetcar stop. You didn't need parking. Then we ripped out the streetcar and built a world where everyone drives, and now we're stuck.
We're paying for a decision made in the 50s.
We're always paying for decisions made in the 50s. That's basically the history of American urban planning. The new restaurants and bars were run by people who understood branding, social media, the power of a well-designed patio. The old Lower Greenville was scrappier, more improvised, sometimes messier. Both versions had their virtues.
Both versions still kind of coexist, right? Lower Greenville in 2026 isn't a museum piece. It's still evolving.
And one of the things that's interesting right now is how the residential side is changing. The parade itself is family-friendly, floats, marching bands, the whole thing. But the after-party scene has historically been pretty rowdy. People spill into the residential streets. There's public drinking, public urination, fights. The neighborhood association has been trying to rein it in for years.
It's the same tension again. The thing that puts Lower Greenville on the map is also the thing that makes life difficult for the people who live there.
That's the story of this neighborhood in one sentence. Patrick's Day Parade is a great example. It brings in millions of dollars for local businesses. It's a cultural institution. But it also trashes the streets and annoys the neighbors. And finding the balance is not easy.
Has the city managed to find any kind of equilibrium?
They've made adjustments over the years. More police presence. Earlier cutoff times for certain activities. Better cleanup afterward. It's less chaotic than it was in the 90s and early 2000s, but it's still a big, messy urban festival. That's part of the charm and part of the problem.
I want to zoom out for a second, because we've been talking about Lower Greenville as a neighborhood, but it's also a case study in something bigger, the way American cities have changed over the last century.
Oh, they absolutely did. I came across newspaper clippings from the early 70s where longtime residents were complaining about the undesirable element on Greenville Avenue, meaning the musicians and artists and long hairs. The same complaints, different decade. Every version of Lower Greenville has been someone's golden age and someone else's decline.
That's the history of cities in a nutshell, isn't it? Change is the only constant. The streetcar suburb replaces the farmland. The counterculture replaces the streetcar suburb. The nightlife district replaces the counterculture. The restaurant row replaces the nightlife district. And in each transition, something is gained and something is lost.
The thing that's gained tends to be more visible. The new restaurant, the renovated house, the rising property value. The thing that's lost is harder to name. It's the texture of a place, the room it makes for people who don't have a lot of money but have a lot of ideas.
Let's talk about the geography a little more concretely, because I think some listeners might not know exactly where Lower Greenville begins and ends. It's a debated question, actually.
The loosest definition is Greenville Avenue from Ross Avenue up to Mockingbird Lane. That's about 3 miles, but most people mean something tighter. The historic core is really from Richmond Avenue to Vanderbilt Avenue. That's roughly a mile, and that's where you find the densest concentration of restaurants, bars, and the Granada.
It's worth noting that Greenville Avenue continues way north of Mockingbird, Upper Greenville, which is a completely different thing. More suburban, more chain stores, wider streets, less pedestrian-friendly. The lower in Lower Greenville isn't just directional. It's almost a value judgment about which part is cooler.
The northern stretch is fine, but it doesn't have the history or the architectural character. Lower Greenville's identity is tied to those early 20th century bones. The narrow lots, the deep setbacks on the residential streets, the commercial buildings that sit right up against the sidewalk. That form creates a pedestrian experience that you just can't replicate with a strip mall.
One thing I want to circle back to is the St. Patrick's Day Parade, because it's been this double-edged sword for the neighborhood. On one hand, it's a beloved tradition that puts Lower Greenville on the map nationally. On the other hand, it's a logistical nightmare for residents, and it's had some real problems over the years.
The parade has a complicated history. There were years in the 2000s where things got out of control. Public intoxication, fights, property damage. In 2010, the city actually considered canceling it or moving it. There were serious conversations about whether the parade had outgrown the neighborhood.
That gets back to the resident versus entertainment tension we talked about. The parade is the most extreme version of that. One day a year when 100,000 people descend on residential streets.
The neighborhood association and the city worked out a compromise over time. More police presence, stricter enforcement of open container laws, designated boundaries for the parade route. It's been tamer in recent years. But it's still a source of friction. There are people who love it and people who leave town that weekend.
Let's talk about the Granada Theater in more detail. You mentioned it opened in 1946. What's its full story?
The Granada was designed by architect Raymond F. Smith in the Art Deco style. It was part of the Interstate Theater Circuit, which was a major regional chain. The opening night film was The Jolson Story, big deal at the time. The theater seated about 1,000 people, and it was the anchor of Lower Greenville's commercial life for about 2 decades.
Then television happened, and single-screen theaters started dying across America.
By the 1960s, the Granada was struggling. It went through a period as a Spanish-language cinema, then closed, then reopened, then closed again. In the late 70s, it was converted into a live music venue, and that's what saved it. The Granada became one of the key stops on the Texas music circuit. Everyone from Willie Nelson to Stevie Ray Vaughan played there.
It's still operating as a music venue today?
Still operating, still independently owned, still has that neon marquee. It's one of the few surviving single-screen theaters from that era in Dallas. The Lakewood Theater is another, but the Granada is special because it's still in something close to its original form, and it's still the heart of its neighborhood.
I want to zoom out for a second and talk about Lower Greenville in the context of Dallas urbanism more broadly. Because Dallas doesn't have a lot of neighborhoods like this. Truly walkable, with a mix of housing and commercial, built before the car took over.
It really doesn't. Dallas is a car city. It was built for cars, it thinks in cars, and most of its neighborhoods reflect that. Lower Greenville, along with Deep Ellum, Oak Cliffs Bishop Arts District, and maybe parts of Uptown, these are the exceptions. And they're exceptions because they were built before car dominance on a streetcar scale.
That's why they're so valued now. People crave that walkability, that human scale. They'll pay a premium for it.
That's the gentrification paradox in a sentence. The thing that makes a place desirable, authenticity, character, walkability, history, becomes a commodity, and the act of buying into it changes it. You can't opt out of that dynamic. You can only be thoughtful about what gets preserved along the way.
Let's talk about some of the preservation efforts, because Lower Greenville has actually done a decent job compared to some other Dallas neighborhoods. The bungalows are still there. The Granada is still there. The street grid hasn't been bulldozed for a super block development.
A lot of that is thanks to the Belmont Addition Conservation District, which was established in 2005. And in Lower Greenville, that question has been contested for 100 years. The streetcar company had its vision. The post-war developers had theirs. The preservationists had theirs. The restaurateurs had theirs. And the current residents have theirs. None of them got exactly what they wanted.
Let's talk about the current moment. What's the state of Lower Greenville right now? What would I see if I walked down Greenville Avenue today?
You'd see a mix that tells the whole story. At the southern end, closer to Ross Avenue, it's still a bit grittier. Older buildings, some vacant storefronts, a few auto repair shops. As you move north, the density increases. You hit the main restaurant cluster around the Belmont and Vickery areas. That's where you find the highest concentration of dining and nightlife.
I want to ask you about a specific historical moment that I think gets overlooked. What happened to Lower Greenville during the Kennedy assassination? Upper Greenville is more suburban in feel.
More suburban, more car-oriented. Bigger setbacks, more parking lots. It never had the same dense commercial clustering that Lower Greenville developed around the old streetcar stops. The streetcar line ran all the way up, but the development pattern was different in the northern sections. His world intersected with the same Dallas that Lower Greenville was part of, the mid-century, growing, sometimes rough-edged city that was suddenly under a global microscope.
Dallas's reputation after the assassination took a hit nationally. There was this narrative that Dallas was a city of hate, that the political climate there had created the conditions for the assassination. Did that affect neighborhoods like Lower Greenville?
It affected all of Dallas. The city carried a stigma for years. But neighborhoods like Lower Greenville just kept being neighborhoods. People raised their kids, went to work, shopped at the local stores. The national narrative and the lived reality weren't the same thing. One of the things I find moving about that period is how ordinary life persisted.
Let's shift to something lighter. You mentioned the restaurant scene. Can we talk about some of the specific food that defines Lower Greenville right now? Because it's not just one thing. It's barbecue and tacos and sushi and farm to table and everything in between.
The diversity of the food scene is one of its strengths. You've got places like Turilli's, which has been there since the 80s, Italian, white tablecloth, live jazz. You've got Blue Goose, which was a Tex-Mex institution for decades before closing in 2022. You've got new wave taquerias like Resident Taqueria. You've got ramen, you've got sushi, you've got craft cocktails. The cycle of urban succession. It's brutal, but it's also how cities renew themselves. The tricky part is honoring the contributions of the people who built the neighborhood while also acknowledging that the neighborhood they built is going to change.
Is there any effort to document or preserve the immigrant history of Lower Greenville specifically?
There's some oral history work being done by local preservation groups, and the Dallas Public Library has a pretty good archive of neighborhood histories. But it's scattered. There's no single definitive account. Which is part of why conversations like this one matter. If you don't tell the story, it gets lost.
That's a good segue to something I've been thinking about. Why does the history of a neighborhood like Lower Greenville matter? Beyond the people who live there or the real estate developers who want to build there, what's the broader significance? But one block east or west, and you're in this quiet, tree-lined world of front porches and gardens.
The tension between preservation and growth. You can study Lower Greenville and understand the whole arc. Usually, you have to choose. Either you live in a walkable neighborhood and accept the noise, or you live in a quiet neighborhood and accept the car dependency. Lower Greenville offers both.
The trees, by the way, are a huge part of this. Lower Greenville has a mature tree canopy. Live oaks, mostly, some pecans. Those trees were planted in the 19-teens and 20s, and they're now 100 years old. You can't fake that. No new development can replicate the feeling of walking under a 100-year-old live oak canopy.
The trees are protected by the city's tree ordinance, which has been strengthened over the years. But they're also protected by the lot sizes. The conservation district means you can't scrape a lot and build something that would require removing mature trees. So the canopy survives.
Let's talk about the future. What's next for Lower Greenville? Because it's not done changing.
The question is whether prosperity has to mean homogenization. The conservation district protects the single-family blocks, but there are conversations about allowing more density on the commercial corridor itself, mixed-use buildings with apartments above retail.
Which is actually historically appropriate. The original Lower Greenville had apartments above stores. That's how streetcar suburbs worked.
It wouldn't be a radical departure, it would be a return to form. But it's politically complicated. Some residents worry about traffic and parking. Others see it as a way to add housing without sacrificing the neighborhood's character. Those conversations are happening right now.
Another thing I think about is climate. Dallas is getting hotter. We're seeing more 100-degree days, longer summers. A walkable neighborhood with a tree canopy is actually a climate adaptation strategy. People can walk to dinner without getting in a car. The trees reduce the heat island effect. The small lots mean less energy consumption for cooling.
The things that made Lower Greenville desirable in 1910, the walkability, the trees, the human scale, are the same things that make it resilient in 2026. Good urbanism ages well.
All right, let's do a quick lightning round. I'm going to name a Lower Greenville institution, and you tell me something interesting about it. The Old Monk.
Opened in 1998, one of the first gastropubs in Dallas, still has one of the best beer selections in the city. The interior was imported from an actual pub in Ireland, the woodwork, the bar, the stained glass. It's not a theme park version of an Irish pub, it's a reassembled one. opened in 2007 on the site of an old gas station. The building is literally a converted trailer, hence the name. Known for frozen drinks and a very specific brand of dive bar irony, it's a Lower Greenville take on a Lower Greenville institution, if that makes sense. Opened in 2009. Dark, moody, excellent cocktails, and a kitchen that punches way above its weight. It's where industry people go after their shifts. If you want to know what's happening in the Dallas bar scene, sit at the Libertine at 1 in the morning.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Here we go.
In the early medieval period, coopers shaping barrel staves would sight along the plank's edge against the horizon, a technique that exploits the optical property of collimation to judge straightness to within the width of a thumb. The practice appears in archaeological evidence from the Atacama Desert, where the extreme aridity preserved wooden cooperage tools dated to the 7th century.
Right. Here's what I keep coming back to with Lower Greenville. It's easy to tell this story as decline and revival. The neighborhood was great, then it got rough, then it got great again. But I think that's too simple. Every era had something worth keeping, and every era lost something worth mourning. The trick is to hold both truths at once.
I think that's right. And I think the thing that makes Lower Greenville special isn't any particular era. It's the continuity. The Granada Marquis has been lighting up that corner for 80 years. Kids have been trick-or-treating on those side streets for a century. The trees have been growing the whole time. That kind of continuity is rare in American cities, especially in the Sun Belt, where so much was built after the car took over. Lower Greenville is a pre-car neighborhood that survived the car era, and that's genuinely remarkable.
It survived, not because anyone planned for it to survive, but because the bones were good. The street grid, the lot sizes, the mix of uses. Those things turned out to be durable in ways that the planners of 1907 couldn't have predicted. They built a streetcar suburb, and what they actually built was a template for urban living that still works 120 years later.
There's a lesson in that. Build good bones. The specific uses will change. The streetcar will become a bus, the movie palace will become a music venue, the head shop will become a taqueria. But if the bones are good, the place endures.
That's probably where we should leave it. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to Daniel for the prompt. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
Take care, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.